Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, the Agency Interpretation Wins Again edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 9, 2011, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Talk America Incorporated versus Michigan Bell Telephone Company. The question in this case was whether an incumbent provider of local telephone service must make certain transmission facilities available to competitors at cost-based rates. In an opinion delivered by Justice Thomas, the court, by a vote of 8-0, deferred to the Federal Communication Commission's view, which was that its regulations require the incumbent provider to make certain transmission facilities available to competitors at cost-based rates if the facilities are to be used to link the incumbent provider's telephone network with the competitor's network for the mutual exchange of traffic. All of the other justices joined the opinion of Justice Thomas, except Justice Kagan. She took no part in the consideration or decision of the case. To discuss the case, we have Daniel Lyons, who is a professor at Boston College Law School. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Lyons.
On June 9, 2011, the Supreme Court handed down its decision in Talk America, Inc. versus Michigan Bell Telephone Company, doing business as AT&T Michigan. The case was the latest in a series of decisions clarifying the duties that legacy telephone companies owe to upstart competitors under the Telecommunications Act of 1996. The unanimous opinion clarified a murky corner of telecommunications law and may also have flagged a broader administrative law question for review in a future term. To understand the question presented in this case, it helps to have a bit of background regarding the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Prior to 1996, most Americans received local telephone service from a rate-regulated local exchange carrier that held a monopoly over local service within a given geographic area. In most of Michigan, that company was the Michigan Bell Telephone Company. The Telecommunications Act of 1996 was designed to spur competition in local telephone service by requiring these incumbent local exchange carriers, or ILECs, to make portions of their networks available to new upstart local telephone companies known as competitive local exchange carriers, or CLECs. The Act placed two duties on ILECs that are relevant here. First, Section 251(c)(3) required ILECs to make certain portions of their network available for lease at cost-based rates on an unbundled basis. Specifically, an ILEC must unbundle any portion of its network that is necessary for a CLEC to compete against it, or if refusal to provide access would impair the CLEC's ability to compete against the ILEC. Unbundling helped the CLEC get off the ground easier because rather than having to build a complete telephone network from the ground up, the CLEC could build portions of the network and lease other portions from the ILEC in order to provide telephone service. Secondly, Section 251(c)(2) imposed a duty on ILECs to interconnect their networks with those of CLECs. That way, a CLEC customer could be connected to a customer on the ILEC's network and vice versa. Interconnection must also be provided at a cost-based rate, and the interconnection duty is independent of Section 251(c)(3)'s unbundling duty. This case involves whether ILECs must lease to CLECs a specific portion of their network known as the entrance facilities. As the Sixth Circuit noted, the entrance facility is just a fancy way of saying the wires that connect a CLEC network to an ILEC network. Historically, CLECs had relied on ILEC entrance facilities for two main purposes. Interconnection, the transfer of a call from the CLEC network to the ILEC network, and backhauling, the transportation of certain traffic back to the CLEC network. In 2005, the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, decided that contrary to its prior opinion, entrance facilities were not among those portions of the ILEC network that the ILEC had to unbundle under Section 251(c)(3). But at the same time, the Commission explained that this ruling did not alter the rights of CLECs to obtain interconnection under Section 251(c)(2). Following this ruling, AT&T announced that because it was no longer required to unbundle entrance facilities, it would no longer make those facilities available to CLEC at cost-based rates. Talk America, which is a Michigan-based CLEC, challenged this decision, asserting that AT&T's interconnection obligation required the company to provide access to its entrance facilities, at least for the purposes of interconnection, even if it was not required to unbundle them. The Sixth Circuit sided with AT&T, which created a split with other circuits, and the court granted certiorari. The FCC filed an amicus brief with the court that sided with the CLECs. The agency explained that its 2005 order pertained only to the ILEC's duty to unbundle. It did nothing to affect the ILEC's independent duty to interconnect. The FCC explained that, in its view, ILECs were still required to make entrance facilities available at cost-based rates for purposes of interconnection. They were simply excused from providing those facilities at cost-based rates for backhauling as well. One might note that the FCC's position is fairly apolitical. The agency took the same position that it had taken in lower courts under the Bush administration during earlier rounds of litigation. In a unanimous opinion, with Justice Kagan recused, the Supreme Court sided with the CLEC, largely by deferring to the FCC's brief. Justice Thomas's opinion explained that neither the statute nor the regulation clearly indicated whether entrance facilities were part of the ILEC's interconnection obligations. As a result, the court would defer to the expert opinion of the agency that drafted the regulation, the FCC. The court invoked a rule of deference known as Seminole Rock, or Auer deference, which holds that an agency's interpretation of its ambiguous regulation is controlling unless that interpretation is plainly erroneous or inconsistent with the regulation, or if there is some other reason to suspect that the interpretation does not reflect the agency's fair and considered judgment on the matter. The court explained that the FCC's brief satisfied this highly deferential standard, and therefore it adopted the agency's view that the 2005 order did not affect AT&T's duty to make entrance facilities available for interconnection under Section 251(c)(2). So what appeared at first to be a complex question of telecommunications law actually turned out to be a fairly straightforward application of well-established administrative law principles. Perhaps the most interesting part of the decision was the separate opinion of Justice Scalia, who questioned whether the court should revisit the highly deferential Seminole Rock test. Seminole Rock is often considered a cousin of the familiar Chevron standard, under which a court defers to an agency's interpretation of ambiguities in statutes that Congress has entrusted the agency to administer. But Justice Scalia noted that Chevron is rooted in principles of separation of powers and a respect for Congress's judgment that an agency, not the court, should fill the gap in an ambiguous statute. With Seminole Rock, however, the agency is both promulgating the ambiguous regulation and interpreting that ambiguity later. This raises constitutional questions about the separation of powers, and it gives agencies incentives to promulgate vague regulations and then save the real work for the interpretive stage, when it's no longer governed by the formalities of the Administrative Procedures Act. Justice Scalia's concurrence is notable because it was he who wrote Auer v. Robbins in 1997, the case that ushered the Seminole Rock rule into modern administrative practice. Justice Scalia's voice joins a growing body of academic criticism of the Seminole Rock rule, which was pioneered in part by Professor John Manning at Harvard Law School, whose article was cited in Justice Scalia's concurrence. No other justice has joined Justice Scalia's concurrence, but it's worth watching this space for future developments.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.